From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Max. What do you have on the show on this rainy spring day?
On this rainy spring day, I talked to Derek Thompson. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He has been there for a long time. He's covered many things. He was at first a sort of macroeconomics reporter in like 2008, 2009. We talked about that. And then he started covering media. And then he started covering science and medicine. And now he sort of writes about, as we talked about, whatever he wants. He also wrote a book a couple years ago. It's called Hitmakers, How Things Become Popular. We also talked about how your own writing gets popular. And he is the host of a podcast that I love. It's called Plain English. And we talked about that too, and how you balance all those things. He's also, so many things, writing a book right now. He's just finishing it up with Ezra Klein. That's going to be out next year. So we talked a little bit about like, what do you think about when it's a column? What do you think about it when it's a podcast episode? What do you think about when it's a book?
Is that, and, is it safe to call that a super group?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But he was really, really fun to talk to about balancing all those things and also how he thinks about audience and how you reach people and how you not just frame the things you are writing about for the largest possible audience, but look for ideas that will be interesting to the widest number of people.
We are delivered to our audience with the partnership of Vox. We thank them very much.
And now here is Max with Derek Thompson.
Hey, Derek Thompson.
Hi.
Here is where I was hoping we could start, because we have done many, many of these podcasts, and I think that perhaps you are the first person who, before being a professional journalist, was a professional actor.
Is this true?
And I've never interviewed someone whose first love was acting. Do you see any relationship between acting and writing? Any relationship between like theater and journalism?
I'll let people in on a secret. Before we pressed record, you asked me if there were any questions I didn't want you to ask. And I will say, this is one of my favorite questions to answer, even though I've been asked it many, many times. I absolutely think that theater and journalism have many connecting underground rivers. And I'll back up by saying I went to undergrad at Northwestern University. I went to the Medill School of Journalism. I think I got way more out of my experience in theater than I did out of my experience in journalism school. And that is no knock on the Medill School of Journalism. It is to say that the world is becoming more theatrical and journalism is becoming more theatrical. So what are we doing on Twitter? We are sort of performing ideas in front of an audience. I have a podcast. A podcast is absolutely theater. It's just theater of the mind. It's theater of ideas. And being comfortable in front of an audience, whether it's on a stage or in front of a mic, is unbelievably important to journalism these days. Even if I didn't have a podcast, even if I weren't on Twitter, I still think that theater is a fantastic education in journalism because it is an education in audiences. And you don't want to be fully captured by your audience as a journalist. But it always pays, I think, to remember that you're writing for someone else. I used to say when I was just 22, 23, and I was writing about economics for The Atlantic, and I knew very, very little about economics at the time, I would say, I'm writing for my grandmother. I'm writing for Momi. And so being able to conceptualize an audience member that I was writing for and trying to make economics plain for was incredibly helpful for developing a voice and incredibly helpful for getting over the anxiety of publishing something for an audience of thousands. I know a lot of young writers that are really nervous about pressing the word publish on the CMS. And I think there's something about getting up and being on a stage and having a high note that you're worried about hitting, and your voice cracks on the G sharp, I was a tenor, and you live. You make it to the next scene, you bow, you go to the next performance, and you try to hit the note again. It allows you, I think, to develop a kind of skin thickness for making a fool of yourself in front of an audience.
Do you think of that as a balance? That is, like, you've got the performance and you've got the ideas and you want the right mix of those things? Or for you, is it all one and the same? Like, the idea is the performance is the idea. They're actually not something that have to be in opposition to each other.
I love this question. And I love this line of questioning. And I've thought about it a lot. So let me try this kind of answer. In theater, in stage, which is what I know best. I've never been in the movie, but I've just done a lot of stage acting. Every great scene is a fight. It's an emotional fight. It's a physical fight. It's a disagreement. There's no interesting scene where the characters aren't fighting in some kind of way. I think great ideas are often fights as well. Often, in order to make an idea really sing, you have to hold it up in opposition to its opposite. So, for example, I wrote an article recently for The Atlantic about the decline of hanging out in America. There's all sorts of data from the American Time Use Survey that the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes showing that Americans are hanging out much less than they used to. Okay, well, that's interesting, I guess. How do I make this idea really sing, though? How do I hold it up against its opposite? Well, I started the article by talking about how, in many ways, America was conceived as the king of extroversion among countries. That when Alexis de Tocqueville visited the U.S. in the 19th century, he couldn't believe how extroverted Americans were. He was scandalized by it. We weren't just hanging out with each other. We were starting new magazines, new political organizations, new labor associations, new sports. We could not stop getting out and hanging out and starting new things. And so I held that up in opposition to the fact that in the last 20 years, American adults hang out 30% less than they did in terms of hours per day, and American teens hang out 46% less.
There's also some incredible number of kids that say they don't have a single close friend?
Right. The highest share of young people say they either don't have a close friend that's in recorded history, and also among those who do have friends, they hang out with their friends much less than they used to. But there's a question of, like, how do I make this idea dramatic? How do I, and this is a way that I think about a lot of my stories, how do I dramatize a mystery that I want to solve? And in every great mystery, the mystery is dramatized, right? Someone is dead and no one knows why. So how do I do that about ideas? That's a kind of performative question. How do I dramatize this mystery? And that's where I think that my theater experience is helpful, because I have this latent subconscious instinct to try to performatize the ideas that I write about.
And how often does that performance, or that way that you think of dramatizing it, how often does that hew really closely to your own experience in trying to answer the question yourself? And how often are you, like, backing into that? So you hang out with the, like, time use survey for a while. At some point in that process, are you like, man, these numbers around hanging out are pretty wild? Or is it the other way around?
It's hard, I think, for anyone to really explain why they're interested in what they're interested in. And so for the moment, I won't even try. But I was absolutely drawn to this when I discovered it, when I found this time series and saw really the extraordinary declines in hanging out times among basically every single demographic. And it is every demographic. Every age group is hanging out less, every ethnicity, married, non-married, every type of education attainment. So that's interesting to me, the fact that all Americans are socializing less than they used to. But then there's the second question, right? So part one is reporting. You're just gathering a bunch of information, and now you have it in a bunch of Excel docs, and I write by just sort of writing down whatever comes to mind in a bunch of different notes, and then I have to collate them together and make a story. That's where the theatrical nature comes in. How do I dramatize this mystery for people so that it really, really hits home? And they think, this isn't just some guy who took his Thursday afternoon to spelunk through BLS data reports. No, like, this is a story about America. How do I make it that dramatic? And so it's a two-part process. The reporting process is sort of led by my own intrinsic interests. And then, of course, the writing process is inflected by this interest in dramatizing the mysteries that I'm trying to solve.
How do you find these ideas? And maybe another way of asking that is, like, how many time use surveys are you working on simultaneously?
Someone asked me this question a few years ago. I was telling a student journalist that they needed to be more interesting, something along those lines. It was a very rude conversation. And they asked a very good question. They said, what does interesting mean? And I was like, I've never been asked that question before as it relates to my own work. I guess to me, interesting is some nexus between novel and significant. There are important things in the world that have no surprise element to them. And that's not interesting because they're just old. And then there's some novel ideas that aren't significant at all, right? Like, you know, celebrity gossip isn't interesting to me, although I'm sure it's interesting to other people. But at that intersection of novel and significant, and when I say significant, I'm typically talking about something significant in some kind of utilitarian way. Like, it affects a lot of people. You know, so I write about the economy because it affects a lot of people. I write about hanging out because it affects a lot of people. I'm fascinated by AI and Ozempic because I think these are, you know, technological revolutions that affect a lot of people. At that intersection of novel and significant, I think you get interesting. But of course, everyone has maybe their own definition of what is significant to them.
And thinking about your grandma as your audience when you started at The Atlantic, is that equation, novel and interesting, designed to reach a larger group of people than your grandma? Are you like, have you widened the aperture of who you have in your head?
Yeah, I thought a lot about explaining to my grandmother economics when I didn't understand economics. And I remember telling some people that I used to have this rule that was called like the 9 a.m. rule when it came to writing economic stories. So, you know, I wake up in the morning, I'm 23, and for a set of reasons that we can talk about in a second, I became an economics writer for The Atlantic. And I was really nervous about that job. And every morning I'd wake up and I would, you know, click around various blogs and, you know, look around Twitter and try to figure out what the most interesting economic question was to answer that day. But I often didn't understand what the hell it was that I was looking at. So that's me at 9 a.m., not understanding. And then at 10 a.m., 11 a.m., 12 a.m., I would call economists and I would ask them to direct me to papers. And I would call other economists, ask them to direct me to papers. And then around, you know, 2 p.m., 3 p.m., I'd start to write the piece. And as I think one of the challenges of writing an article, especially when you've done a lot of reporting on it, is that you develop the curse of knowledge. You lose track of what makes the thing interesting to someone who hasn't gone on that reporting trip with you. And so I try to remember at 3 p.m., the questions I had at 9 a.m. and begin with those questions. So if I was writing about, you know, and what were people talking about in 2008, 2009, why unemployment was so high and the role of government stimulus in changing employment rates, I would try to remember what are the first questions that the average smart person who is not an expert in this subject going to have about this subject, and how do I maintain sort of 9 a.m. mindset even when I'm writing at 4 p.m.?
That makes sense to me. So you need to like stay in touch with what you were curious about in the morning. But as your curiosity changed, were you looking for different things? Were you looking for bigger stuff? Like, how did that curiosity evolve?
I guess the way I think about it is I was always looking for big stuff. In 2008, 2009, I was, you know, lucky / unlucky enough to be drafted into writing about the economy when the economy was the most important mystery in the world. It was the Great Recession. And it was such a fascinating journalistic topic. Around 2010, 2011, the recovery got relatively boring. We were growing at the same rate every quarter. We were adding the same number of jobs every month. And so I changed my beat. I moved on to a new mystery. I thought the most interesting question in economics and in culture was what was happening in entertainment. The rise of streaming, the new business models in music, the new business models in journalism and news media. And I thought that the internet revolution in media and entertainment was the most important story in the world. And so I pretty much just shifted my entire beat from being a macroeconomic reporter to being a economics of media reporter. Not because my conception of that which was important changed, but rather because my conception or my threshold of importance, I think, stayed the same. And I thought, how do I find another beat that is as fascinating and as mysterious and as significant for tens of millions of people as the Great Recession? Oh, well, maybe it's these changing media economics that are going to, you know, overturn entire industries and entire companies and remake the future of this sliver of the economy.
So you actually feel like you started with something where the stakes were unbelievably high and then just kept shifting it as you could.
That's right, yeah.
Can we just go back very quickly, because I'm sure there's some people listening who wonder how you got drafted into being an economics reporter in 2008. How exactly did you end up with that gig when you were a theater actor at the time?
Right, right. So I got a media fellowship at The Atlantic in 2008, which at the time meant that I was essentially like a communications intern. I was making PowerPoint presentations for The Atlantic Media Company, not The Atlantic, but the media company that owned it, about what kind of opportunities existed for us to create a new political website or business website. So I was a PowerPoint jockey. And one day, someone at the company came into my office, walked over to my cubicle. I definitely didn't have an office. And they said, hey, this guy, Connor Clark, who's now a law professor, has left being the economic blogger for theatlantic.com. We asked him who could fill his seat, and he said you. And Connor and I were really close friends at the time, still are. And I said, no, don't make me do that. What are you talking about? I was like, I don't know anything about economics. When I got the Washington Post, I grew up in Washington, D.C., the only section of the newspaper that I would immediately throw in the trash was the business section. I would read every other section. Please don't make me write about economics. I'm going to embarrass you, and I'm going to have a miserable time doing it. And I remember I went home and I told my parents, I was like, this is crazy. Like, being asked to write by The Atlantic about economics is like only wanting to play shortstop for the New York Yankees, and the New York Yankees call you and they say, we're drafting you to be our catcher. And you're like, I have no idea how to do that position, but I'm still so thrilled by the opportunity. So they ultimately said, look, if you suck at this job, we're just going to fire you back to being a communications intern. So there's really no risk in it for you. And I took the job and threw myself into it and really conceived of it as having to get a kind of warp speed master's education in contemporary economic policy. Read as much as I could, talked to any economist who would pick up the phone, and tried to carve out a niche of being able to explain economics in plain English to people who threw out the business section of the Washington Post, like I did. And I really was put in an extraordinary position to fail without consequence. And if you're a young person put in a position to fail without consequence, it's an incredible gift.
I guess that helps explain why you never left the Yankees. It's been a long time since I talked to someone who has worked at one place for their whole career.
The Atlantic is a really special place in that it has allowed me to change my job every few years. And I don't think there's a lot of other media organizations that encourage their staff writers to change their jobs the way I've been allowed to change my job. I was drafted, so to speak, as a macroeconomic blogger. I then became a media economics blogger. I was then briefly the business editor of The Atlantic. Then I was a business columnist for the magazine, writing about general business issues. For a while, I was really a pure sociological essayist, writing about the decline of religion in America and things like why people aren't hanging out anymore. For another sort of 9-month span, I was really focused on, and this is what the book that I'm writing about is dealing with, public policy and the barriers to building things and innovating in America. And then I've changed my job again, and I have a podcast with The Ringer, and for The Atlantic, I'm all over the place. I mean, I am writing an article right now about the restaurant comeback in America. The article before that was about hanging out. Article before that was about political science and the idea that Americans are addicted to chaos, I'm truly allowed now to write about whatever I want. And that's just such an extraordinary gift that I do not take for granted. So, you know, hard to leave a place that essentially says, you say it and we'll give you a green light.
It's interesting to hear you describe what the job is now. I was sort of waiting for that because reading back through the last, I don't know, 18 months maybe of your writing, it was really hard to figure out what the through line was, you know, whether there was a beat or a single theme. I couldn't really pin one down.
I wouldn't say there's a theme at all or a beat. I would say there's several themes and several beats. The subjects that I find most fascinating today include America's social disconnection, and that's a category under which I would include rising teen anxiety, the question of American happiness, the paradox that even though we're richer and more technologically sophisticated than we've been in previous decades, in many ways, a lot of Americans are more anxious and more disconnected from each other. So there's that bucket. I'm really interested in medical innovation. I think that what's happening right now in some cancer drugs and certainly with Ozempic could change our lives as much as any frontier technology in the world. And then finally, I don't know how you can be a writer given a green light on anything in the world right now and not be interested in American politics. And so I'll always have at least a toe in the question of what the hell are Americans thinking? And it really is like this deep, profound mystery. Like, Trump is a cliche at this point, but it's such a rich mystery. It's not something that people, I think, can really truly get to the bottom of. There's so many things going on there in the question of his enduring popularity among half the electorate. And so I'll always continue to play in that. So to make it brief, I'd say that right now my sort of triptych beat is number one, American dislocation; number two, innovation and progress, especially in the medical field; and number three, the political psychology of American voters.
Well, that seems like a pretty clear distillation of the currency. Now I feel like I should have been able to put that together. It does make me think, though, Derek, like one of the things having talked to all these writers on the show that does become sort of clear over time is that people who write for a living are often writing about themselves in some way. They are writing to figure something out about themselves in some way. Do you feel like those three things also impact you directly? Like, is that part of the consideration? Is that part of what draws you to topics? Is it something that, even if it's as broad as American politics, are there personal stakes in these things? Do there have to be for you to get as into them as you do?
Maybe. It's a really beautiful and deep question about, you know, whether a person's work is in some way a reflection of their soul. I think in some ways, yes. You know, both of my parents died of cancer in my 20s. And since then, I've always been interested in the question of why is the war on cancer so difficult to win? This is a war that was announced by Richard Nixon in 1971. It's been reannounced by basically every president since. There are some cancers that have had incredibly declining mortality rates, and other cancers, like my mom died of pancreatic cancer, my dad died of a more mysterious one that was never fully diagnosed. Pancreatic cancer's mortality rate hasn't budged in 60 years. Billions of dollars thrown at it, and it hasn't budged. There's no way that someone in my position who is paid to investigate mysteries and lost a mom in his 20s cannot be interested in the question of why did the war on cancer fail, and what are the frontier technologies that might actually help win some battles in the war on cancer. On the front of American dislocation, I suppose it has something to do with me and the fact that I think about my own happiness, but it's, in a way, I almost feel like it's crazy for anyone to need to defend one's interest in the question of what makes people happy. It's almost a cliche to be interested in the concept, in the subject of human happiness. And I do think on the medical innovation front, I think that might be downstream of the fact that my own family has just had these tragedies that has sharpened my focus on this subject.
Wyze is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wyze just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wyze takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Vox Creative.
This is advertiser content from 26.2 Team Milk and their new docuseries, Running Sucks.
Is running the worst?
Yeah.
Do you love it? Do you hate it?
I hate it so much. I hate it so freaking much.
That you're a real runner now!
I did it.
I'm Abby Ayers, a 37-year-old mom from Utah who found herself running across the Manhattan Bridge in my first race ever.
Running Sucks celebrates women who run and the running communities that carry them across the finish line.
Running helped me in so many ways postpartum.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
For every person like you, I'm telling you, you belong, and I'm telling you, you can do it.
I never thought the words would leave my mouth, but yes, I'm planning on running a marathon. I can't even say it without laughing, because, like, who would have thought?
Watch Running Sucks at runningsucktheseries.com and learn more about how Team Milk is helping women runners across the country conquer their next course.
When you can write about anything, how you make those choices is really interesting to me. You know, I mean, I think like the ability to write about anything is so rare in the media landscape we have. And yet it feels like it's such a big part of what's working for you is that at least as like as a reader of yours, part of the fun of it is to see where you're going to go next. You could have given me like 24 hours locked in a room and I wouldn't have come up with restaurants, you know?
Right. So it's funny because the feedback loops are sharper with podcasts than with articles. So I get lots of feedback from the articles that I write, but the feedback loops are sharper and the feedback is more specific on my podcast. And so I host this podcast, Plain English, with the Ringer Podcast Network, which in many ways is a reflection of the sort of articles that I write for The Atlantic. And sometimes I'll write an article for The Atlantic and it'll go big, and so I'll want to do a podcast episode on it. Early on, when I was starting off Plain English and working with Bill Simmons on the podcast and trying out a bunch of stuff and paying really, really close attention to what people were saying, I thought that the podcast, quote, wanted to be a news podcast, that people were interested in news mysteries, and this podcast would say, all right, this was the cover of the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal yesterday. I'm going to talk to an expert about it and then do that every, you know, twice a week. And the feedback I got really specifically was, do not do that. What we like about this show is having no idea what's going to pop into our feed on Tuesday and Friday, that it's going to be a talk with a psychiatrist about teenage anxiety, and it's going to be a talk with some scientists about the future of cancer, and it's a talk with a political psychologist about Trump voters, and it's whatever, restaurants, friggin' restaurants. And they were like, this is what we like about it. We like the randomness. And that was another very lucky green light for me, because I am an inveterate dilettante. I lose interest in subjects all the time, because what I find interesting about my job is the invitation to solve mysteries. And once you solve one, two, three mysteries in a space, then the meta mystery of that space begins to dim. And all these other subjects that you see on Twitter, that you see in the New York Times, that you see in the Atlantic, that you hear about in a podcast, oh, that's the, I don't understand that. That's the new unlit space that needs the flashlight. And that's the part of the job that I love the most, that there are so many dark corners in the world, and I've just got this flashlight, and I can just shine it wherever the hell I want.
I have to imagine there are people listening who are both inspired by and jealous of what you're saying. And I wonder if you've got any thoughts or advice or anything about how, like, how did you get to this place, man, where the thing you're supposed to do is exactly what you want to do?
There's no point starting anywhere other than luck. One of my least favorite genres of professional advice is when people essentially dictate their memoir and say, do that. that's so fucking unhelpful. I got really, really lucky in a lot of different ways. I was lucky to get the media fellowship at The Atlantic, for starters. This was 2008, where to get any interview at any magazine or newspaper as a 22-year-old or 21-year-old already puts you in the stratosphere of luck. I got lucky again to be an economic writer at The Atlantic. I was lucky to land at an organization that has weathered a lot of storms in media. And I've gotten lucky countless ways since then. So we have to start with luck. The second thing I would say is that I'm not sure it's entirely the case that everyone wants to do what I do. When I give people, younger journalists, advice, you know, there's a way in which I sometimes give them advice that's very counter to my experience. I say, actually, you really shouldn't try to be a generalist. I'm not exactly sure how my career happened. And I feel very uncomfortable telling someone to try to, you know, move through the hopscotch and obstacle course that I went through to land at the position that I'm in. I actually think that when you look across media and you look at the journalists that I most admire, they tend to be specialists. They tend to have discovered a really specific niche. I think it's much more helpful to look across the landscape and say, what's the general most likely success story of dozens of successful people, not just one? And that I really think is developing an expertise and really becoming known as best in class there.
But I think there's one other element of what you're talking about that it makes me think about, which is like, I do think there's an element of it that is about taste and about being in touch with your own taste. Like, if you can follow your actual curiosity, the thing you are genuinely interested in, even if it's only taking you into, you know, dark places within a specific niche, it's going to keep being interesting to you and therefore to your audience.
I love that thought. I think it is easy, especially when you're a younger journalist, but maybe at any age, to become someone who writes for their editor, right? Which means you're writing for the intermediary, not for, sorry to use tech language, the end user. I would highly encourage anyone who's starting their career to never think about writing for the editor, because that takes you out of yourself. You're no longer really being honest to your own curiosity if you're just writing to satisfy an editor. You want to always keep in touch with what you actually find interesting about a subject and trust that if it's interesting to you, sincerely interesting to you, it's probably going to be sincerely interesting to thousands, tens of thousands, maybe millions of people.
Do you have an audience in mind now?
It's fuzzier than Momi, for sure. I'm not sure that I could name it. I'm not sure that it has a face. I think it's probably in many ways a kind of externalized version of myself at this point. I do kind of in a Rick Rubin kind of way trust my own taste here, that if it sounds good to me, it'll probably sound good to enough people. I think I lean on that. But unlike Rick Rubin, I haven't sold 100 million records. And so I don't have perfect confidence in my taste. And actually, honestly, I constantly think about this question of like skin thickness as a writer. That when you're a young writer, I think people have too thin skin and the criticism can ruin your day. And the harsh word from a manager totally destroys your confidence. I think a lot of older writers, especially older successful writers, can develop too thick skin. Nothing anyone says hurts them. And you need to really think about sort of skin thickness and optimal skin thickness, I think, as a writer. Like, what kind of feedback do I most, am I open to? And especially with the podcast, I think people just have really emotional feelings about podcasts. There's all sorts of like really mean things that have been said about the show. And what I try to do is disentangle the ad hominem from the substance, right? Just because someone sounds like an asshole doesn't mean they don't have a really, really good point. And so how do I remain just open enough to being really hurt, to having my feelings hurt? How do I open that door just enough that really helpful advice can slip through without, you know, my entire day being ruined. And that's not some kind of formula that I figured out. I'm not, you know, trying to suggest that I've, you know, developed this like optimal skin thickness formula. But it's something I think about all the time, because while I do think, to your point, I kind of trust my taste, I kind of trust that if it's interesting to me, it will be interesting to a lot of other people, you can't be so hubristic as to think that you're beyond feedback. No one is.
Do you think that the systems of feedback that we have right now are efficient?
Well, they're terrible.
Are they working for you?
No. Well, are they working for me? It takes work to make them work for me. So people can email me. They, you know, they can tweet at me. The Bill Simmons subreddit has all sorts of feedback. I'd say 70% negative for the podcast. It's a generally negative space. So I'm not sure that I'm that my sort of you know, relative to the average score is above or below the critical line.
But you go and read that stuff.
I do. Yeah, I absolutely seek it out. It's really important to me that I'm in touch with what people think about my work. Because again, I'm not writing it for myself. I am writing it for other people. I want to help inform and also entertain. And if people feel like I'm getting some major thing wrong, or if they think I'm being an asshole, it's actually kind of important for me to know that.
I feel like this is the first time I've heard a compelling argument for reading the comments.
Interesting. I absolutely read the comments. Again,
maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like that idea has been described as like a terrible thing that one should never do, and if you do it, you like don't really talk about it.
Mm, interesting. Well, I do it, and here I am talking about it. This is wait. Did you didn't press record, did you? This isn't actually going up. I think it's really important to be able to read the comments. You know, I'm not going to go like full Nietzsche here, but the real weakness is not being able to read the bad stuff. That's the fear, is not being able to even expose yourself to the possibility of negative feedback. The position of strength is being able to read the negative stuff and forget about it in half an hour, but retain the useful substance in it. Like, that is the strength. Determining that just because someone writes a comment means their feedback is invalid, that doesn't make any sense to me. I would much rather put myself in touch with people that have feedback for my work and learn from it and allow it to shape the next thing that I write about than to be in this position where I say, I don't think I'm strong enough. Criticism and validation from people that you're writing for, of course that has value to me.
Are there things either as a writer or a podcast host that you're actively working on, like things that you are trying to get better on from story to story or episode to episode?
Yeah, in my writing, because I know that I write articles about subjects that can be a little bit vegetable-y, I'm constantly thinking about caramelizing the vegetables. Like, how do I make the vegetable, how do I make this as edible as possible? I really want people to be able to engage with stuff that might be a little nerdy. On the podcast, I'm working on 1,000 different things. I really enjoy what I do, and I love being able to talk to different people across different subjects. I think I'm still trying to learn how to balance, how to get that really difficult balance between being authoritative and being conversational. I think that it's interesting and challenging, I think, to really understand how much of your humanity and your personality do you want to shine through? And how much, to a certain extent, do you want to be a neutral backboard for the interview? And I listen to people on both sides of this equation. You know, I listen to people where I feel like they're very tie up. And then I listen to people who I feel like, you know, they're unbuttoned down to the navel, you know, proverbially speaking. And, you know, finding sort of the right button height, I think, is something that I'm still working on as a podcaster. How much of my personality do I want people to see versus how much authority do I want to have as someone who exists sort of without, you know, disclosing all sorts of things about myself?
You wrote a piece, sort of like a call to arms to stop asking smart questions.
Mm.
I mean, basically the argument is like the simple question is going to get the best answers, and asking incredibly complicated questions that prove how smart you are going to get pretty unrevealing answers. Does that idea feel connected to like how much of yourself you need to bring to the show and how much you need to be in the background?
Are dumb questions good radio is something I'm constantly thinking about. I mean, I remember my dad was obsessed with Charlie Rose, and I'd watch Charlie Rose with him from time to time. And I was constantly shocked by how simple Charlie Rose's questions were. Like, it sometimes seemed like he would, you know, have these enormous tomes, these books that looked like they weighed 20 pounds. You know, it'd be like whatever. It'd be like Napoleon. And Charlie Rose, like, begins the interview by being like, now, Napoleon, how big a deal was he? You know, it starts so simple, and it managed to like uncork some really interesting answers. So sometimes I think simple questions can be really, really provocative, and sometimes I think they're actually like kind of cheesy. And that article that I wrote about valorizing simple questions was really about reporting, that in the reporting process, it's often really useful to ask the dumb question, because then you get a really substantive answer. But sometimes in radio, in podcasting, something I do that I think is probably a little bit strange, but I need to do it just to satisfy my mystery solving, is someone will give an answer to a question, and then it'll give me an idea, a theory that explains the subject. And I'll say, okay, you just explained how Ozempic works and about how there are GLP-1 receptors in both the gut and the brain. I want to throw this theory at you, and please just tell me if it's stupid. It sounds like you're saying that Ozempic is kind of a psychiatric drug. It's kind of a brain drug, not a gut drug. And I'll say, is that right? And then they say, that's incredibly stupid, Derek. You didn't understand a single thing that I said. Or they'll say, yeah, that's helpful and directionally accurate. Those kind of questions are actually the most helpful to me.
Like, test the theory.
Test the theory. And that way I can actually, right? We hang up the phone or we press end on the podcast. I can go to my wife or go to my friend and say, I think I understand a thing. I can repeat a lesson from this show because I said that lesson to the expert and he said, yeah, that's more or less right. So that's a skill that involves both listening really, really carefully and on a parallel track, both synthesizing what the person is saying while thinking about the next question. And as you know, like, it's really tough sometimes to both listen to what someone's saying while having this verbal track in your head that's like, this is the next question that I'm going to reconceptualize after he finishes talking finally. That's a skill that I'm constantly working on as a podcaster.
One thing that I've seen you doing more, both on the podcast and on Bill Simmons's podcast and in your writing, is not just trying to make sense of current moments, but trying to think about what's coming next. Like, I feel like you've been getting into like the prediction game a little bit. Does that feel fair to you?
So, right. Bill Simmons and I have this semi-annual tradition called The Future of Everything, where he asked me to come on the show a year ago. And he said, you know, one way that we can use what your podcast does, which is hop around all these different subjects, one way we can sort of synthesize that for my show is we can have this game called The Future of Everything. We take four categories, you know, health, sports, politics, tech, and you make a prediction, I'll make a prediction, and then we'll discuss them and move on to the next category. And I said, you know, that's a great way to bring Plain English onto the Bill Simmons podcast. So I'm not against that game at all. It's just fun to talk about the future because, let's be honest, the future is totally unfalsifiable. There's no data from it. It hasn't happened yet. So one of the bullshit of futurists, like the bullshit of being an actual futurist and that being like your job, is that your job is to describe to people that which they can't tell you you're wrong about. I mean, and that's an absurd position. That's not particularly journalistic. But what is journalistic, I think, is, you know, something like, and maybe this is a little bit cheesy, but something like the edge of the present. You know, me saying, here's what I understand is happening with Ozempic. If this continues, the next click of the dial will look like this. So yes, it's prediction, but it's most, but 90% of the prediction in a weird way is a description of the present.
Do you worry about getting stuff wrong?
Yeah, I'm freaked out about getting stuff wrong. You know, the last podcast I did was, I think it was literally titled, What Economists and I Got Wrong About the Economy. And this is a podcast about how I've been underrating the effect of higher interest rates on Americans' negative sentiment about the economy. I get stuff wrong all the time. The really nice thing about having a twice-weekly podcast and a weekly, semi-weekly column and Twitter is that I have a lot of swings at the bat. So while I am terrified of getting some big thing wrong and hurting my reputation, I also know that if I get something a little bit wrong, if my interpretation of some major event is like 80% correct, but I've missed some big 20% chunk, I can come right back the next week and write about that 20%. And it's not like I'm a book writer where I'm only publishing once every 4 years. And so I know those answers to the question might seem like they're a little bit in tension. I'm very concerned about getting things wrong, but I also know that I can always just sort of make them right the next week. But that is kind of how I feel about it.
That just sounds like medium thick skin to me.
Thank you, man.
How do books fit in? Like, you've got the podcast twice a week. You're on Twitter. You're writing for The Atlantic. How does a book fit? What part of your brain does that occupy?
Right now, it occupies a lot of the brain because I'm finishing up this book that I'm writing with Ezra Klein. And one thing that I learned writing my first book, especially when I had just come off being a blogger, is that writing changes so much as the length of the work changes. That in a way, blogging is pure writing. And by the time you get to a book, writing a book is actually not entirely writing. It's almost more organizing than it is writing. Like, one way that I thought about it is, like, if you're writing an article, it's almost like shopping for one shirt, right? I'm just looking for one data set about Americans hanging out less. And once I find that data set, I found my shirt. I can write the article. Writing a column sometimes, like a 3,000-word column, is, you know, it's more like, you know, buying furniture for a room. It's a lot of buying stuff. And when you buy it, you have to, like, lay it out. And once you've laid it out, you're like, okay, now the room is together. I mean, writing a book is like buying a new house and outfitting it with furniture. I mean, it is, yes, it's about buying stuff. But the biggest job for a new house is figuring out where all the damn stuff goes. And that's, I think, the major challenge of a book. So that's how I think about it at a conceptual level. And in terms of how I think about it at, like, a time level, sometimes it's a little bit, there's switching costs, right? It's very difficult to go from, you know, just finishing a podcast that I just recorded on why Hollywood's hit formula of superhero films seems to be nearing its end, to immediately writing about, you know, writing my new chapter for the book. There's a little bit, there's a switching cost there, but it's not a switching cost that can't be fixed with just a long walk. Walk outside, look at a few trees, the mind is wiped, you can go back to the new thing.
Hey, Derek, thanks for doing this, man. I really appreciate it.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor this week was Seth Kelly. Thanks to him. Thanks to Susan Peterson, who handled the show notes. Thanks to everyone at Vox, with whom we make the show. And thanks so much to Derek Thompson. You can find his writing at The Atlantic. His podcast is called Plain English. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance
and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.